Welcome to Jack Theology. We're back after being off for a few months.
Yeah, finally, right? Here we are.
Yeah. We took a winter and spring break.
A sabbatical, a siesta. I don't know. I don't know what the word is, but yes, we took some time off.
It's good to be back and better than ever, as they say in the business. I am Matt. I'm joined by Kevin, and just want to give some updates. We've been out for a few months. I'm curious how, I know Kevin, you're working hard on your book, how that's coming. I got to read a pre-draft copy, which was exciting to do that.
How's it going? It's going well. You know, one of my mentors, our mentor Leonard Sweet, had this statement that he said that a book is never finished, it's only abandoned. And I really kind of felt that way, that I just, you know, it comes to a point where you're like, you just have to give up. And so I was telling Len about this the other day, and he said, no, you forgot the end of the statement. A book is never finished, only abandoned in despair. It was like, I've never had the despair and anxiety and depression in my life as when I finished a book and turned it over. And that's just kind of how it feels. Like, there's like, you know, I feel like I should be excited, but there's this like overwhelming like depression that came when it was done, because it's like, you can't go back and change it. And then there are a whole bunch of things that you wish you'd have done differently. And then it's like, is anybody going to read it or like it? And you know, what are the mean troll's gonna say? So you know, it's been messing with my head, Matt, but I'm glad to finally, after more than a year working on it, to finally be literally done. I can't change a word in it at this point. It's going to print.
Okay, well, congrats. Exciting. When does it come out?
July 3rd.
July 3rd. We can pre-order, right?
Yeah, we can. You can get it Amazon. I don't even have a picture of it on here, but you can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Reconstruct Your Faith. And yeah, it's available for pre-order there. And I would appreciate that a lot. It's interesting. It's going to be probably a little bit more progressive than some conservatives might like, and it's going to be a lot more conservative than a lot of progressive might like. So you know, so I'm in true style, I'm probably just going to make everybody angry because I'm just, you know, kind of going to go right down the middle of some of these things. But it's my journey and my deconstruction and reconstruction, and hopefully people will be able to find things that are helpful to them in there, or people they know.
Yeah, I thought it was well done. I mean, of course, I'm your friend, so I'm a little biased.
You have to say nice things. Actually, friends have to say the hard things, right? That's the deal. That's the agreement.
No, I thought, honestly, you. I read it on a flight to, actually, I'm part of an Anglican group that I participate with, and got ordained priest in the Anglican spirituality. With a diocese called the Diocese of St. Anthony. And I was reading it, and it struck me because you had told me about it. It was going to be your journey, but you didn't tell me that how specific you were going to get into kind of ancient faith, which Anglican spirituality is really all about, the ancient faith, and about the different practices of the early church and throughout history that we've kind of lost. So in some ways you don't really like go right or left. I mean, on some things you do address some of those stuff, but a lot of it's just like separate from that. It's just like getting back to the ancient roots of our faith, which actually like was perfect for me as I was flying to this event, you know, thinking about the ancient ways and all of that. And so I thought it was helpful. I think people, it'll give people good handles and good tools if they want to reconstruct their faith as they go through deconstruction. Cause I think you're right on that. Like, are, you know, the ancient ways is it centers us, it keeps us grounded in Christ in the right ways. So yeah, I really
kind of hate the word deconstruction, and a lot of people hate the word reconstruction, and I hate, you know, they kind of had to use those words. It is about that, but frankly, it's more about, you know, people who are struggling with their faith, especially with their faith in regard to maybe questions about church or questions about the Bible or questions about, you know, Christianity or politics. I think people who are wrestling with faith and with questions and don't know where to turn, the whole kind of hope or goal of this book was to give you ways in which to maybe rethink your faith in other ways than maybe you'd been taught as an evangelical. And, you know, the ancient church I think there's a lot of things there, as you said, that are helpful in helping us navigate a lot of these questions that we're facing today that a lot of people are having kind of difficulty wrestling with and through. And, you know, I don't want to see anybody walk away from their faith because they felt like there wasn't an environment for them to ask questions or because there wasn't any room or space for them anymore. And I think the early church gives us a lot of great examples of how to maintain faith in creative ways that evangelicals, that the church today doesn't necessarily utilize as much as maybe they could to help people maintain and grow.
Yeah, that's good. And you told some good stories. They were funny. And I could see my journey in some of those. So it was a good, well written book. And so I hope everybody goes out to get it in July or order it now. And
yeah, my crisis of faith happened in a place that you were very familiar with. And so it had to be very interesting to read that, you know, through the lens of you knowing where that space is and having been in that space.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, but you recommended it to me, so it makes sense why you did.
I guess so. Right.
Yeah. He tells his story while he spent some time at a monastery, which I've actually been to as well. And some readers, it's a you know, somewhat famous monastery because of Henry Nouwen, who spent some time there. So some other readers might have the same connection I did as well. So yeah, pick that up. That's great. How's your, I guess we could talk about that at the end, the jacked, I'm curious how your journey to,
it's quite a story. Yeah. Let's save that one till the end.
Yeah, we'll save that to the end. So for me, yeah, I guess my journey over the last few months and kind of busyness that kept us away from podcasting was, you know, spent some time getting ordained priest, which was like a powerful moment. I didn't realize how powerful it was going to be. I had been in this journey, kind of in this group for a couple years. I'm just praying with them and then kind of journeying, learning about the ancient faith and all of that. And then, you know, took a step of faith to be ordained and go through that process and wasn't sure about it. And then when the moment happened, I was just kind of overwhelmed. It was like, you know, I had spent some time recently at a local monastery and God had spoke some things to me there. And then it kind of came full circle in a moment. And so, it was a cool experience, cool thing. Powerful, I guess, from God to me. And I feel, I always say this, I feel, you know, I get used to wearing the collar. I mean, you wore the collar for a while in a role and in many ways, I don't even think about it anymore. And I've been on this journey throughout my ministry career of becoming missional to like express Christ to the world. And I never felt more missional than when I wear my collar. I never felt more. There's been so many doors and opportunities have been opened to me over the last few months, just by simply wearing the collar or being present as a priest, into a moment. And so even today I got invited to pray at Rutgers. They do this service, interfaith service for, students that lost their lives during this past school year. And so I got to be there for families and friends of the students that have passed on and pray. And it was just a powerful moment and all because I kind of stepped into this, role as a priest. So it's been cool. So that's what I've been up to. Of course, yeah, there's always,
it's amazing, Matt. I love because so much, you know, you and I grew up in evangelicalism, steeped in it, and so much of evangelicalism, especially in the era that we grew up in, it was about eschewing, you know, cutting ties from anything that was ancient, cutting ties from anything that was old. And so, you know, I think that was partly or maybe strongly based on Catholicism, you know, kind of a overreaction and an overcompensation after the Reformation. But we lost, I think, all this rich and great history of the church. And so what I love about, you know, your journey of being ordained as a priest is that you're connecting back to ancient roots, you know, that you're grounded in a way. And there's, you know, so many beautiful rites of passage in the church, so many rhythms that we just don't practice anymore. We, you know, maybe baptism and marriage in a way, for some denominations, confirmation, but beyond that, there aren't very many rites of passage. And I think a process of ordination for a priest, for a pastor is an important and moving rhythm and rite of passage that we may devalue a little bit too much. And so I'm proud of you for kind of taking this journey and for finding ways to reconnect back to the ancient roots of the church, which I think are still good. It's not just, you know, I think evangelicalism or sometimes fundamentalism that sometimes, I mean, I know we give them a hard time, but, you know, those aren't the only two wings of the church that have lost their way over the years in one way or another. And how do you reground or recorrect after those things? You have to go back to the start, to the roots. And so anytime I see somebody like you doing that, it just, I think it's the right move. And I'm glad that it felt right and it felt powerful and that you're on that journey.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we throw Catholicism, you know, ancient practices out because the church failed so much, and the church continually fails so much. And we talk a lot about those things on this podcast for the evangelical or Protestant stuff going on today. And it's similar, like people are rejecting the faith, what they're rejecting is evangelical churches, Protestant churches losing their way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. The evangelical and Protestant church of today is in a lot of ways the Catholic Church of 500 years ago. You know, the Catholic Church of today is not the Catholic Church of the Reformation. But in a lot of ways, the evangelical church today is in the same place and motivated by a lot of the same things that the Catholic Church was motivated by before the Reformation. Money, power, empire. You know, these are the things that Martin Luther railed against, you know, that Calvin railed against in Catholicism. And today, in a lot of ways, evangelical and Protestant Christianity is mirroring the worst of what they revolted and rebelled against 500 years ago.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, maybe I should tweet that. Somebody write that down.
You can add that to your book.
No, I can't. I can't add anything, Matt. Come on.
No, it's so true. And that kind of leads into our topic we wanted to talk about today is, like, I think the Protestant church has lost what made the, I guess, evangelical Protestant church go and I think was valuable was they developed community really well. They gave people spaces to connect that weren't connecting in culture around the same idea, you know, values and worldview and even hobbies and certain churches would build community around that sort of thing. But now, because the Protestant evangelical church has shifted to, you know, aligning with just power, influence, and they want money and all of those things, and people see it, it reeks. I mean, abuse obviously too is appalling in the church. It's, you know, come out and been prevalent. So people are rejecting that, and they're losing a sense of community, and the church no longer focuses really on building community. It's just showing up to an event or what have you, or you know, just showing up to give your money and that sort of thing. And so you had a nice tweet this week about that, about how kind of the church isn't the place people find community anymore. And I see that practically, anecdotally, on the front lines of ministry. And you know, I'm sure that's where your tweet came out of as well, from your own experience.
Yeah, it did. It came out, you know, I mean, CrossFit, frankly, whenever I got in CrossFit over the years, it was like, this is an amazing community. And this small group of CrossFit is like ministering to me better than a lot of small groups in the church that I was in. And those small groups were my responsibility. Like, I'm like, I'm failing. CrossFit is doing it better than me. And then over a few years, I began to meet people as I began doing this Christ Table ministry. I began to meet people who were in AA. And a lot of the folks who come to the ministry, that work that I do now, are or have been a part of AA over the years, and hearing their stories about AA, like AA is doing ancient practices, frankly, better than the church is. Like those rhythms that we were talking about, that made the church what it was, a force to be reckoned with spiritually. AA is doing better, and so you know, as you begin to think about it, and you begin hearing about people and their experiences in secular community groups, you realize that they're more compelling to people than the groups that are created in the church. And it, in one sense, it makes sense to me, but on the other hand, it doesn't make sense to me, and I have a hard time reconciling it.
Yeah, you brought up your tweet was places that do community and koinonia fellowship better than the church. You listed AA, CrossFit, Comic-Con.
I had to throw that in there for the nerds.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, Comic-Con is a movement, right? Of community.
Yeah. Actually, I follow this CrossFit YouTuber, and he did just to develop his YouTubing skills, he did a whole thing on Comic-Con and their community, and it was fascinating. But yeah, there's a huge community there. Dog parks, drag shows, the Waffle House, food banks, hiking trails, the bar. And then if churches want to end the Exodus, they should learn why people prefer these. And then you ask, where would you add? Yeah, I mean, I see it. Like we have AA that meets here at the church. And most people go, and the majority of AA people just go to AA, right? And a good mega church pastor would probably count those people as members of his church, but I don't do that. You know, we have AA, I go to CrossFit, so I've experienced the same things you were talking about. And I'm curious, and in some of these other things like hiking and then even running groups I've been a part of, or, you know, the bar, you know, coffee shop, you go to the same places over and over, you develop community, you feel welcomed, make friends. What is it about these places that like develops that? Like, what is the church missing here?
Do you have an answer? The first thing that came to mind. The first thing that came to mind for me was, and this is going to sound terrible, I don't know that I even have an answer for getting around this. They're not selling Jesus. You know, there are a lot of groups that aren't on there. Tupperware parties, you know, essential oil, whenever you're a part of these things. I don't know if there's anything. I mean, Waffle House is food, but no one's there like trying to sell you something or convince you of something. It's not a timeshare sales pitch. And I think that so often what happens inside of our church community groups is it's a carrot, it's leverage in order to provide or convince us of something else. It's not community necessarily for the sake of community and getting to know people. We call them community groups. We talk about community a lot, but I don't know that the church remembers or understands anymore. We've become so disconnected as church leadership. I don't know that we really understand what true community is and what true community looks like. And unfortunately, culture doesn't have a lot of examples of this much anymore. People don't sit on their front porches. People don't walk and stop by people's houses and talk generally. A lot of our communities, if you live in Florida, it's this way. If you live in some other, you know, coastal, you know, you've got walls and borders around your neighborhoods where people can't get in or out. We've lost the ability in a lot of ways to have community, except for these small pockets of things that bring people together who are passionate about something, and then they begin loving and caring for other people who are compassionate about what they care about. And so it's not as though I think that that doesn't necessarily happen in church small groups, but I don't think it happens to the extent or the depth that it happens, or that churches think it happens in their groups. And from an outsider perspective, I just think that there's a complete disconnect. You know, if you're an insider in a church, you may experience that in your small group. You may experience that in your community group. You may experience that on your volunteer team. So I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but I don't know that the depth is there like it is out in the real world, because a lot of the folks who are doing small groups and who are doing volunteering, like, they're completely insulated from other outside community groups. That's the only thing they do. A lot of us is just volunteer and serve in the church and nowhere else. And I just think that we don't understand what it's like to be an outsider from those. So we think we're welcoming and we think that we're helpful and we think that we're community. But I just think that most people experience it to a greater degree and a lot greater acceptance in other places like Comic-Con, in other places like AA. And it's not that the church can't do it. I think we think we're already doing it, and we have such a dim view of all of these other things because we've got the truth. We've got Jesus. You know, people aren't going to want to be sold your Jesus unless they're sold on the fact that you love them, even if they don't buy Jesus.
Yeah, that's where I went. Like, sorry that allergies today is really messing me up. But the full acceptance, like I go to CrossFit, if I can't do a muscle up, no one cares, right? They're going to accept me. They're going to cheer me on. If somebody can't even do a push up or a full squat, it doesn't matter. You know, they're going to be accepted, loved, cheered on, just like, you know, the best guy in the gym or gal in the gym. And then same with AA, you know, you could be sober for a decade and you have a moment of relapse. You're still going to be welcomed and accepted. I read something recently where a guy was saying how he always came, he didn't go to church because he didn't feel accepted, but he always went to AA because he always felt accepted. And it was like, I think that to me is the biggest thing I see, right? And I think you're right. And I think it's all connected to our view of the gospel. So most Protestant churches, evangelical, even Catholic churches will say, you've got to get your life cleaned up a certain way. So there isn't full acceptance. Even if we say, I welcome you, you know, all are welcome here. There's still the the conversation behind that is, well, if you keep doing that, you can't do certain things, right? And even in those environments where people feel connection in community, they're not completely themselves, right? Like I've been in those environments where I'm connected, I'm friends with people there, and I don't feel life. I don't feel the energy, the same energy I do elsewhere, because I'm always on guard. Like I feel like I can't fully be who God created me to be. And that's not even people. Some people say, well, you just want permission to sin. Well, that's not even what I'm saying. Just, you know, just to be me and to interact with people the way I want to interact with people, it doesn't necessarily make it wrong or a sin. And so, but in churches, you know, well, here's an example. It's not a sin, but I was in one church that it's like, I got harassed because I wore open-toed shoes, right? I wore sandals in the summer to church, right? And I got chewed out for that, that type of thing. That's not a sin, but this is the way churches treat people. And I think that is a huge issue for folks. They just don't feel accepted. And it does go back, I think, to Jesus a lot. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, let's be honest, a lot of churches don't want you to feel accepted. You know, that's the theological first step is you are not accepted unless you're not accepted by God, unless you do this, you're not accepted by God, unless you believe this, you need to repent. And so, you know, that's, a lot of folks that's what they lead with is no, you're not accepted, but do this, change this, and you will be. We still love you, but you and I talk about this all the time. Yeah, whatever. You have a broken definition of love if that's what you believe that love is. If you're redefining terms like hate in order to say that you love somebody, we have no starting point. But a lot of churches, that's the thing is we don't accept you. You're not accepted by God. And so change this. And okay, that's your theology, that's your belief, whatever. But stand in the shoes of someone who is far from God. Stand in the shoes of somebody who is coming to the church for the first time in a long time or never. Stand in the shoes of somebody who invited somebody for the first time, you know, to church that they've come and they've been trying to get them there for years, and they come in and that's the first thing out of the gate. That person's never coming back. You can be, I don't even want to talk about the theology of that. You can be right, but you can also handle it so badly and with such a lack of love and care, which is what community really is about, right? Compassion, love, care, meeting people where they are and letting them know that, you know, you may vote differently than I do. You may work at a different place and make a lot more money or less money. You may be more educated. You may be very, very different from me, but we can still understand and love and care and have compassion for each other despite all those differences. And sadly, in the church, whenever that's the theology, most of the people end up becoming those who can't have compassion or care for those people who they feel like need to repent or they don't accept. And the church has a real image problem and a real action problem, I think, in those ways.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's connected to forgiveness, right? Are we willing to forgive someone who doesn't meet our standards? Because let's be honest, every one of these clubs have standards, right, that they want people to uphold. You know, AA, we want to stay sober. CrossFit, you want to eat healthy, come to class every day. Comic-Con, I'm sure I'm not familiar, but they have shows, you know, the dog parks have rules, right, that you have to follow. You know, I joined a mountain biking club a couple of years ago and there was rules to follow. But what I sense from those community groups that I've been involved with was when you mess up, you don't reach the standard, there's constant forgiveness. And part of accepting someone is to forgive them. And so in the lectionary, we're going through, you know, post-resurrection Jesus. And you look at what Jesus did. All the disciples but one left Jesus. One of them, you know, betrayed him. The other 10 scattered, left him. And there's just John, you know, standing there by the cross, right? And so Jesus didn't say, like, he didn't chastise them. He didn't say, you got to go clean your life up. He said, here, have some bread, have some fish. Touch my hands, touch my feet. You know, he welcomed them, he forgave them, and then called them to be people of forgiveness. And that's what we're called in the church to be, as people of forgiveness. And I think we've forgotten that. I think.
But Matt, there was that one time where he said, go and sin no more, to that one woman who was having sex with some guy that no one ever talks about the guy. And there was that other time at the very beginning of his ministry, he had that one line, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. I mean, come on, Matt. I know he had 3.5 years of ministry, but there were two sentences where, you know, Jesus said, I hate you. So come on, Matt. Repent.
Yeah. I mean, even the repent part, I could argue he's talking about living a life of forgiveness.
What? Wait a minute. You mean that we have mistranslated the word repent? Come on. you mean Jesus didn't say one sentence that had nothing to do with the rest of his ministry and and we don't even have that? Come on, Matt.
Yeah, I mean that's you. I mean you're making fun of the problem, right? I think why community doesn't happen. Exactly that. They don't see Jesus for who he. They ignore the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, for the I don't know, the God of the Old Testament that really doesn't exist. It just exists in their mind. Yeah. And who wants that? That's not life-giving. That's not resurrection. That's not something that people get excited about. And so they're not going to be excited about Jesus. So you're right when you started with, you know, they're not selling Jesus because no one wants that Jesus.
No, I think, you know, people are like, well, you know, if they reject the church and they reject Jesus' message, then that's on them. I'm like, they're not rejecting Jesus' message. They're rejecting you, asshole. you come at me that way. I'm going to reject you. It's like, they're not rejecting Jesus. You know, Jesus walked up to somebody and said, you know, repent for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Change your mind. Turn around for this new thing is here. They're not rejecting Jesus. They're rejecting you.
I mean, I have conversations at least once a week on Rutgers campus with students who don't go to church or atheists or what have you, fill in the blank. And they like Jesus. I have no problem interacting with them on Jesus, but they all have stories of being burned by some pastor or some church leader or, you know, some neighbor who called themselves a Christian. And it's fascinating to listen to because young people, college students, are very honest and open with you about their feelings. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not really Jesus that they're mad at. It's all those weird church people.
So isn't the forgiveness part, you know, for, you know, students, for college kids, is it just being distracted? Is it the church's image? Like what? And I don't even know where to begin on turning this around for the next generation, but you have the ability, you know, to have unique insight because you interact regularly, in a ministry, in a pastoral role, with a lot of kids who just, I don't know, I guess they would be a nun when it comes to religion. It's not compelling. It's not important. I don't know. What do you?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. You know, you want to meet people where they're at. I think I try to go to where students are at. I try to keep my ear to the ground on where there's pain points that I could, you know, bring life to. You know, something gets vandalized on campus, death on campus, those sorts of things, be present. Our ministry tries to do something around exam time because that's a pain point. And students are willing to, you know, engage with you then. And so hopefully build relationships, invite them into community, true, you know, authentic community that they are welcomed. And there isn't a hierarchy, but there's a lot of baggage. And so I think we're at the point where I don't think we can expect, because we send a flyer out or we promote an event, that a bunch of people are going to come. I think it's like these one-on-one conversations to distill, to unpack all these layers of hurt, of pain that people have experienced. And it's hard because it's not just maybe their immediate church they grew up in or their neighborhood that they grew up in. It's like the news. They get bombarded with it. The news, social media, all these voices on the internet that are speaking, you know, I would say things that aren't of Jesus, that they're hearing, and they think they connect that to Christ in the church. And so they don't want to engage with that. So I think, honestly, it's really just is meeting people on the street one-on-one in relationship and trying to, you know, like you said, create space for them to share. Maybe there's ways in which you could do that broader and more, you know, I'm thinking of some folks like Nadia Boltz Weber, who does a good job of creating like space for those folks to like share in a more public, you know, more people around kind of setting. I think there's probably ways to do that, but yeah. I'm trying to still find my way.
And I wonder too, if it's contextual, if, you know, churches, if individuals, if communities, if it's more about finding where the missing, where the holes are, what's not being provided, you know, in their community, and filling that. You know, I love the idea of one-on-one, individual versus communal or corporate. I mean, even, you know this certainly, but the way we use the word church, you know, the Bible uses the word church as a people, as a community, not as a building or an institution. And so, you know, I like the idea that the solution to some of these problems isn't necessarily in a program or inside of a church building or an institution centric, but it may be more individual. That's the more difficult route to go. But I'm just not compelled to think that the church can offer as vibrant a community situation as some of these things, you know, as AA can. You know, churches have tried to duplicate AA through Celebrate Recovery, but this is what churches end up doing. They end up, you know, instead of CrossFit, you know, you've got the Lord's Gym, or you've got the, you know, the workout room in the church facility downstairs in the basement with 1960s and 70s workout equipment. You know, okay, come work out here rather than going to your local LA Fitness. You know, so, you know, the church tries to recreate badly what people are finding more compelling and better out in the world. So as a Christian, you know, I'm almost like, as a Christian, it's like, go join CrossFit, you know, go walk your dog in the dog park, go sit at Waffle House at 2 a.m., you know, go to these spaces and be the presence and light of Jesus and of hope, and be willing to just simply share your story if asked or if it comes up. So, you know, maybe the best thing that the church can do for community is just be in the community.
Yeah. You have to put your ego aside, because
I have no ego.
We Protestant evangelical types like a big crowd. We like, you know, to promote all this stuff. And it's like, well, I don't know if I want to do that one-on-one thing or in smaller setting thing, because that doesn't, I mean, you know, I think it's ego driven a lot of times, but some of it too is like, it's not going to pay my bills. And I think too, like, you know, kind of going to American pastors here is like, we have to shift the way we think about paying our bills, you know, because I think the church has changed a lot. It's not what it was. And I don't think it's coming back anytime soon, but we're still called to be the presence of Christ in the world. And so what does that mean? I think it looks a lot different. And it can be very valuable. It can be very powerful, even more powerful in people's lives. Going to CrossFit, I was thinking as you were talking too, you know, CrossFit, that sort of thing, it started in a garage with a couple people, you know, and it blew up because it was built on certain things that, we've talked a lot about them here. And I think that could be part of it too, is we truly just like invite people into our living rooms or meet them in their living rooms or coffee shop bars and see where it might go. And truly, you know, be that presence. And if it doesn't go anywhere, being okay with that, right? Like, it might not go anywhere. It might just be, you know, stuck in the same kind of conversations for a long time. Yeah, I mean, and then AA, you know, I think, the Celebrate Recovery thing, like, gets me, like why churches have to copy what's already going. Just open your space for, like, what's already working. Like, just embrace it, be a part of it. You can influence it. I don't get why the church feels like it's always got to reinvent things that's already working somewhere else. We do that a lot.
That sounds like a podcast.
Yeah, a lot.
And it's always badly. Yeah. It's just it never. Yeah.
It's never.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're out there. I mean, if so, tweet it to us. You know, comment on Facebook or whatever, wherever you're watching. If there is something that the church has recreated that the world has done and we've done it better. I want to know what those are. Let me know. There have to be some out there, but I have to admit I'm at a loss to think of any.
Well, there are things we did that the world, outside the church people copied that we did better, you know, but like every Ivy League school was started by a church. So we actually started schools, we started hospitals, you know, but those came out of a heart for God and serving people and being a presence of Christ in the world. It came from that heart of Jesus, those things, not from a situation where we're trying to expand, grow, build an empire, you know. Anyways, yeah, that is another podcast. But Yeah. So I think we've solved the community problem now, but we've thrown some thoughts against the wall that I think are valuable. And so I thought the next segment, we kind of do this anyways, but we could title it, our brief thoughts on the news of Christendom. There's a few things.
Yeah, let's go for it. You keep pretty in touch with what's going on. So what's on the docket? What's been going on this week?
Well, the first thing we should talk about would be he's in the news a lot. Mark Driscoll. He likes to
the most. He's Mark Driscoll, what, out in Seattle, you know, started a big movement, Young Restless Reforms, Neo-Reform. Was he a part of X-29, the start of that movement?
Yeah,
kind of blew up, came back, lots of drama, lots of trauma. I was listening to him this week. He's not a very likable guy, but he's a phenomenal communicator. you want to like him and believe what he says. So what's he up to?
So he went to this Stronger Man conference that is run every year out in Missouri.
Stronger Man, okay.
And every year they try to pitch the conference as like a man's man conference. So like
lots of testosterone.
I first saw a video of it last year where they had like a tank come run over a bunch of cars and like they were shooting fireworks off. And this guy, I didn't respond to your text today, but he was dressed like Rambo. Like he had the bandana.
Was he? Yeah. Cause nothing says manly man than a tank and shooting fireworks and Rambo.
He was shooting a couple guns from top of the, you know, it was crazy. So this year, I guess they invited Mark Driscoll to speak. And right before he spoke, they had,
sounds very homoerotic. This tank thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is everything in the church homoerotic when it comes to men?
It's all bad.
There's another podcast there too. The
sexual
weirdness of men's thing in Christian circles. Anyway, I keep derailing you. Go ahead.
No, Christian men's groups for sure are homoerotic. it's probably not for public consumption, but yes, men's groups are very.
But if it's not going to be talked about on Jack Theology, where's it going to be talked about? We need a podcast on this. Come on,
dude. I told stories to my non-Christian school-going friends about how we thought being naked in the dorm room was funny, and and shaking our naked bodies in front of each other at different random times.
Yeah, yeah. And Christian college, same thing with mine. Yeah.
Yeah. None of my friends.
Actually, we went to the same Christian college in different years. So maybe it was just something about that college.
I don't know. Well, my other Christian college friends did that.
Okay. All right. So it wasn't just because I was getting worried. It wasn't just a Christian college. Yeah.
But
what do your secular friends think of that? Does that not happen in secular university?
No, it wasn't a thing.
But what do they do?
They just get drunk. Maybe one guy would get so drunk he would like run around streaking. But
that's got to be like about repression, right? Like you've never seen another naked body, and so once you're in college,
I think so. I mean, they had sex in college. We weren't allowed to do that,
I mean, it didn't stop us. I mean, I did it, but it still happened.
It still happened, but
it was frowned upon.
It was repressed, let's say.
That's the word, I think, repressed. There was lots of repression among those boys who ended up in Christian liberal arts and Bible colleges. And that repression came out in very sideways energy situations in dorms.
Yes.
And apparently it's still coming out of very sideways energy situations in men's conferences by the name of Stronger Men.
So they hired a stripper.
Okay. A legit male stripper. What for?
Well, I haven't found definitively if he's still a male stripper, but he used to be for sure. And he was, he's like a Cirque du Soleil dancer now, I think. But I don't know if he still, I don't know if he still does male stripping, but he used to. And so he did this kind of thing. The video clips that are out there, really all you see him doing is taking his shirt off and climbing a pole, like a strip dance pole.
Okay.
But he wasn't, I don't, at least
at a Christian men's conference, this seems interesting. What?
Yeah, he didn't seem like he was dancing provocatively in their defense. He was showing off feats of strength to climb the pole, like with his arms, but his body was kind of perpendicular to the pole.
So I'm imagining something like in between, okay, there's a pole, so pole dancing, but like a gymnastics, like, routine, almost like, I mean, people do weird things in CrossFit. Like, I mean, I can imagine like next year CrossFit's always trying to do new things, you know, instead of muscle ups, it's going to be like holding onto a bar sideways.
Very gymnastics-y. Yeah,
so it's showing, so it's showing the physical prowess of a young male in his prime who can do things that beer belly Bob, you know, in his plaid can't accomplish at a Stronger Man conference.
Well, I think what set Driscoll off, well, it may be part of that, but I think was the sword. He swallowed a sword. Let's talk about homoerotic. He swallowed, he took a sword and swallowed and stuck it down his throat. One of these. Yeah.
Now, oh dear God, edit. Kevin, edit.
You didn't know that part?
I mean, repression, homoerotic, nothing wrong with sword swallowing, but I'm just saying, you know, I'm not just saying anything. So this happens. So a dude in tights without a shirt on does these feats of strength, sword swallowing, based around a pole at a men's conference. And so what happens?
So Driscoll comes up to speak and basically calls out. He says this, what we just had here was the Jezebel spirit, which Driscoll, if you watch him at all, he uses that language, Jezebel spirit, for anything that he really doesn't agree with biblically. So he clearly thought what they were doing at this men's conference before he got up was unbiblical.
Okay.
And so he said that that was appalling, and he kept going on and on about the Jezebel spirit. Then what I thought was funny, I mean, that's either here or there. You could argue and debate about whether that was appropriate. Probably not super appropriate for a church thing, but it was on brand for this thing, you know, based on past history. This is the type of thing they do. They want to show feats of male, alpha male things. So Driscoll maybe shouldn't have signed up to come if he didn't like that sort of thing.
But I mean, maybe he did like that sort of thing.
Maybe. He called him out, and then the pastor of the church that was hosting this then kind of shouted back at Driscoll that he was out of line. And then Driscoll stormed off the stage. Like a little child that he is. And then eventually I think they came back.
Really?
I'm not sure how much longer, how long it took them to come back. That's unclear, but they came back on stage and they were Matthew 18 each other.
So there's a male show that crosses some line for Driscoll, and he turns it into an opportunity to talk about a Jezebel spirit in the church or whatever at a Stronger Male conference, which gets him, as men would do, gets him canceled from the stage. He leaves. This is bad and weird from so many angles.
I mean, where to begin? I mean, Driscoll, he projects this sort of energy from his preaching all the time. So it's almost like pot meat kettle. Like, they're putting on stage this thing you don't like, but honestly, Driscoll, look in the mirror. Like, this is how you are in your preaching and how you talk. Like, you might not put this person on your stage, but this is the way you act. You are preaching with a sword down your throat and showing your feats of strength on this stripper pole. You do that. I mean, I laughed when I heard him. I'm like, oh my gosh, Driscoll, are you that unaware of who you are?
What if you know? I think that I'm like, you know, this is like the stronger male conference. Like, these are the men's men. Like, Driscoll has kind of put and positioned himself as this like man's man, and you know, even just this whole Jezebel spirit, like, using a woman, you know, from the Bible who wasn't a great woman, but like, you know, why not an Ahab spirit? Why is it a Jezebel spirit? Because women are evil. You know, like, for all of this manliness and stronger men and all of this, you know, testosterone and macho-ness, I mean, forgive the reference, but they're all kind of acting like middle school girls here. Like, this feels like a middle school girl overnighter where they're, you know, they're like a cat fight. But like, where are the men in this room? You know, you all are acting like wusses.
Yeah.
Like, who gets bent out of what speaker? Who gets bent out of shape over a man with his shirt off doing feats of? I mean, have you watched military parades? Like, you know, have you watched American Gladiators? Like, Driscoll probably in the sermon a week ago was like lauding American Gladiators, which was so much more homoerotic and homosexual, you know, if that's the thing that he's against, than anything that guy did on the pole. I just, come on, grow up.
I mean, Driscoll's the guy who sat in front of a fire and then had his videographer put fire on the screen talking about how if men didn't become men, that the world was going to burn in hell, you know? And he used Jezebel's spirit in that video as well. Like,
I feel like it's all just an act. I feel like it's all not
Jezebel's spirit. Like,
because Driscoll didn't say it was a Jezebel spirit. So it clearly isn't. I feel like so much of what happens in Christianity, especially right now in like male macho nationalism, you know, ultra Republican, MAGA, what it's everywhere. It's not just somewhere, it's everywhere. Is this like fake male pretending, you know, I've got a gun, you know, I've got a bigger gun. Like, you know, okay, that's homoerotic. You know, like, you're measuring the length of your guns. Like, I just, like what is going on? Like, go outside and touch grass. It's like in college, in a Christian college, where everyone's like shaking their naked bodies again. And the whole outside world is looking at this saying, are you all insane? Like, what are you doing? Like, this is not normal. Like, touch grass and then go sit in a therapist's chair. Like, you need help. Like, and I'm looking at this thing that's going on in male Christendom and like, y'all, this isn't normal. And what you have normalized is not just plain weird, but like, let's talk about Bible and anti-biblical. Like, it's like creepily outside the boundaries of the Bible that you profess to believe is inerrant.
Yeah.
Go look at Jesus.
Yeah, he I think he'd be uncomfortable around Jesus.
He'd be very uncomfortable around Jesus. He would be saying Jesus has a Jezebel spirit for the way Jesus acted and interacted with other people.
I mean, you bring up a good point. I mean, there's so much to unpack, but, you know, using the word Jezebel and not Ahab or just a satanic spirit, he has to use a woman's name. It's fascinating. But, I mean, he thinks women are evil. I mean, he's come out of the closet. I mean, he used to be kind of like putting women down, but now that he has no real authority around him anymore, like, he's full on like, you know, women are the devil. So I guess essentially that's what he's saying.
It plays, it sells. And that's sad. I mean, I know that we sometimes can say that, you know, everybody's a grifter, everybody's about sales. But at this point, sadly, with Driscoll, it's I don't know. You know him better than I do. It feels like it's maybe he truly believes all of these things and he's drunk his own Kool-Aid. But so much of it just feels like it's whatever is the most sensational, you know, the biggest grift.
He is a grifter in many ways. I mean, that was the biggest thing that got him canned at Mars Hill was he did the whole thing where he used the church's money to buy himself onto the, you know, New York Times bestseller list with his last book because it wasn't doing as well as his first couple that made it kind of organically. And then, you know, he lied about it and all that kind of led to his whole downfall. And there's stories of him just showing up to John MacArthur's conference, to try to sell a book, just being, you know, crazy Driscoll, calling out John MacArthur at his own conference. He picks fights, you know, to get in the news. He does that. I'm sure, you know, part of me, thinks he was just looking for a way to call these guys out, from the beginning. I mean,
so
this is the way
he wanted.
This is the way that some of these guys think. Like, I've been around them and they say yes to these things knowing full well they're going to go in and call them out. I know for a fact Matt Chandler did that when he got invited to speak at Stephen Furtick's like revival meetings about 7 or 8 years ago. I don't know if you remember those, but
no, I don't.
Yeah. But he went he said yes intentionally just to call out Furtick. And if you go, that you can actually find all the sermons from that like revival meeting that Furtick did, except for Chandler's. They took it down.
Wow.
Also, what an ass. And I think what we saw too on stage is two megachurch type leaders using their manipulative tool to get people to submit to them in this kind of, they've created a verb. I'm going to Matthew 18 them, right? And you have to submit to me because I have Matthew 18 you.
Yeah, so Matthew 18 is what? The process, you know, Jesus' process of confronting sin, which the church has kind of taken as a to-do list or a process for discipline, usually used by people who don't like things going public, negativity being out there publicly.
Well, so that, that was
because it starts with going privately, you know, rather than publicly.
Yeah. You should have came to me privately. You should have told me privately, you know, it was back and forth on this.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about like the dueling megachurch leaders, like just the uncomfortableness of that playing out on a public stage against each other.
Yeah, because they're both used to being the ones in the power position and getting what they want out of that conversation. And in some sense, neither had the power here. I mean, Driscoll's the more famous one that probably a lot of people signed up to this event to come see. And, you know, here's the leader of the event who leads a large megachurch in Missouri. Clashing of worlds. And that's fascinating. Because it really didn't work for either of them. I didn't watch
it's a pissing video. It's a pissing contest, and everybody loses in a pissing contest, right? Yeah. Like everybody gets wet, everybody gets pissed on in a pissing contest. Yeah. So, I mean, part of the language, but it's like, and the outside world is like, yeah, y'all can have your little contest, but everybody's just getting doused in urine. Like either, you know, we're watching it from the outside, like, who wants to be a part of this community? Y'all are insane. Like this is, listen, are you listening to yourselves or you're watching yourselves? And you know, all the whole Christian community around it is validating it, you know, by arguing and pontificating and, you know, you should have done this, you should have done that. That wasn't right. Like y'all, people from the outside world, this is insanity.
But the other thing that's fascinating is, and this is kind of off the actual event, is the response on Twitter. So like, you know, one of the themes I notice on Twitter that people like to fight about is what is a man in it? You know, should we be alpha man or beta man, or you're not a man because you have pronouns in your bio, all that stuff. Right. And we've gotten me and you have, you know, have had fun with it over the last few years.
I get that all the time. I haven't been a man for years on Twitter. For one reason or another, I'm just not a man. I have accepted my status as, I don't know, something that isn't fully male.
Well, yeah, they don't believe in non-binary, but they call you a non-binary. Yeah, I've seen that. It's so ironic. You're not male or female. But what's fascinating is a lot. Not a lot, some of those guys I've noticed were posting against this event, right? Like, and there was various opinions on if Driscoll was right and wrong, but what they were saying, all of them that I read were saying like, this event is not a picture of biblical manhood, which I thought, wow. I actually commented to one guy, Wendell, our friend Wendell on there.
Wendell! Wendell Talks, I think, is his handle on Twitter. And
yeah.
I kind of wish we were Wendell Silent.
Yeah, Wendell should be silent most of the time, but he actually gave this little like snapshot of like biblical manhood, and there was really nothing I could disagree with. And I said, Wendell, I disagree with everything you have ever said except for this one tweet. Like, I was so shocked. I was like, wow. Like, and so I'm noticing that this one event actually, in some ways, is serving to bring the church together online. It's like, this is not it, guys.
I don't know. I did a little bit of research on this. I don't know what stripper or I'm guessing. It feels like that's a label the church has given him. Is okay. That, you know, was he actually a stripper or is he just a dancer? You said Cirque du Soleil, so I don't know what his story or what his background is. I don't know that I care. What is this guy feeling? You know, I mean, he's been drug into this epic argument between highly fundamentalist and conservative Christians over manhood and Jezebel and what's appropriate and what's not. And I'm just thinking, this dude was invited to a Christian conference. Maybe he's a Christian, I don't know, but it doesn't sound like maybe he has always been. If he is now, has been invited to this to legitimately utilize his gifts and his experience and his background and what he's doing in order to bless, you know, in order to entertain, in order to be leveraged by this conference in one way or another. And just, you know, what is that fair? You know, is it fair to him? Was it fair to them to invite him? I don't know. I'm just like standing in shoes thinking, what's he thinking today? How's he feeling? It kind of just breaks my heart.
Probably thinking, I didn't get paid enough for that.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe a star rises because, yeah, you know, his name's out there more, but maybe he'll get some other churches who will hire him to come on Sunday mornings. Yeah.
I mean, to me, watching it, it was definitely not erotic. It wasn't like, even if he was a male stripper in his past, he wasn't up there stripping. Like, you know, it wasn't anything like that. It wasn't erotic. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's sad. That's a whole artistic thing. You know, in our world that a lot of people are involved with, both Christian and not. So I think, you know, in some ways, Driscoll is probably putting a fear for people to engage with that sort of art. You know, or maybe he just doesn't understand it. I mean, like you said, they all acted like kind of third graders.
I love that word art. I actually love that you brought it back to that. The church has a very unhealthy and I think an inverse Christ relationship with art. You know, the arts and art. And I've never really understood that. And the only thing that I can figure is that it must have something to do with freedom of expression, freedom of delving into emotion, the uncomfortable awkwardness of allowing someone to dive deeply into who they are, the masculine, the feminine sides of themselves. I don't know, but the church just is uncomfortable, if not antagonistic and anti-art. And it's moments like this that I think, you know, I think that that's what kind of about him, you know, is he is an artist. He was there doing his craft and doing his art. And it isn't his fault that he was there doing that. He was invited there to do that and then leveraged in multiple ways negatively for doing that, leveraged both by Mark Driscoll to prove a point and also leveraged by the event itself. For some odd reason, why this is masculine, I don't know, but either they were leveraging him to look masculine or leveraging him as the opposite of masculine. And there was a plan at some point to do that to him, whether it was Mark or someone else, I don't know, but it all just feels, it doesn't pass the smell test. Yeah. And the way that the church utilizes art negatively in order to prove points is abhorrent to me.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, that would be sad if this was planned, but I wouldn't put it past him. I wouldn't put it past him to have planned this. Create publicity. We're talking about it. Everybody's talking about it.
The fact that we would even say this is, hey, you know, they might have said something. You know, the fact that our first thought isn't there's no way this was planned. There's no way anybody would do this or go this far, like to prove a point. The fact that, you know, both you and I were like, you know, it's possible says far too much about the church.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great way to end this conversation. We'll get to other news next week because we plan on being back weekly.
we plan on being back, and that's a good thing.
I gotta get to my son's track meet, so I want to hear about your jackness, though.
I mean, it kind of feels wrong though to talk about lifting and working out after just like making fun of a stronger man conference, right? Though, are we not just like playing into these stereotypes anyway? Maybe that's a joke though. We're doing it ironically. Yeah, I feel like I've been preparing for like this bodybuilding competition for like 3 years when it should take like 3 months to prep for it. It hasn't been 3 years. It's been about a year. But the coach that I was with up until a few months ago, it just wasn't a right fit. You know, I've learned who are in this. They have the folks that they really invest in, and then they have the folks who help kind of fund them. And so it just wasn't kind of interested in moving me as much towards the show quickly as he was, I think, just kind of keeping me on the line. So it was kind of the slow path rather than the fast path. I'm like, I can't eat like a competitive bodybuilder for years. Like, you know, the eating regimen is super strict. Like I can't just do this month in and month out. So transition, found a different coach. Unfortunately did that like just after the prep time that's legitimate for spring shows. There are only spring shows and fall shows. So it'll be, if I do it, it will be in the fall or not at all. So we're moving in that direction, have, you know, changed up some of the eating plans, have doubled down on some of the workout stuff. And it's interesting, like I had really been losing ground over the last year. Fascinating, like you're paying, like I'm paying with $200 a month or whatever for a coach to specifically for this, for these events, which is normal for what you'd pay somebody to help prepare you to get here. And I'm like losing ground over the space of that, you know, 9 months or a year time. Like I'm watching my body go backwards rather than forwards towards the goal. So it's nice to finally have somebody who I think is a little bit more intentional, meshes a little bit more with me. Love the old coach, but this guy is just a little bit more intentional and tuned in. And so finally starting to make progress in the gym and on lifts and get back to where I was. And so, you know, at my age, I'm like, you don't want to lose ground because you may never get that ground back. It's not like, you know, you're 25 and, you know, with 27, I can still be in great shape. It's like, you know, when you're 46, you're like, you don't gain ground. You know, the hill is always headed down. You just hold it on. So the fact that I've been able to like climb back up the backside of that hill a little bit, I'm thankful for that, but we'll see if I still have enough energy and dedication in me to get me to a place where I will not be embarrassed standing on a platform.
So yeah, if that all fails, my gym here, the muscle gym I go to, does in the spring. So they just did it at the end of March, but they call it show off your shit show.
Okay. I actually love that. That's something the church should copy from the world is that title. I love that.
And it's kind of guys and gals like yourself and myself, really. Like, she's trying to get, maybe I'll do it next year. The lady who runs the gym trying to. Yeah, you should come up and do it. It's great. She runs it like a show. But it's a joke too. It's kind of a fun day. I've attended it and watched it last year. And it's a fun thing. So yeah, maybe come up in the spring.
Yeah, I'll come up. I'll come up and watch it. And I mean, do it, man. Come on.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, being out on the East Coast, especially in the Northeast, there's a lot more access, I think, to stuff up there than there is in other parts. Like Florida, you know, was rough. Alabama is rough. Like, you know, there are communities and pockets of barbell clubs and a lot of weightlifting stuff that isn't present everywhere. And so, you know, even I was talking about community today. I wish I lived up where you were, because, you know, you've got a lot more kind of support and options and opportunities that those folks down in the Deep South have.
No, that's true. That's true. I'm still on the same, nothing's really changed for me with, CrossFitting. And I did get hurt, which set me back. I messed my knee up again. I didn't go to the doctor like an idiot, but it was, I've had the same injury. It just flared up. I call it a flare up, but it set me back for like a month. I did all my exercises that I know the doctor would have me do, and it got better.
If you're not recovering from an injury or preparing for an injury, is it really CrossFit?
Yeah.
I mean, once you kind of get into those older, you know, CrossFit ages, it's like you're either recovering from an injury or you're just prepping for your next one.
I know. Well, I heard it doing an air squat, you know, air squat.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was a lot of air squat. It was just an overuse injury is what it was. But
That had to be it.
Yeah. Anyways.
Go be with your son, man. We'll see you next week.
Exactly. See you, man.